Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Ernestine Lyons, host of Quick to Politic, the podcast, the social commentary show that explores topics ranging from social justice to history, economics, small business, and of course, local and national politics. Thank you for joining me. Audience. Thank you so much, listeners and viewers out there. This is Quick to Politic, and it is a very special episode of Quick to Politic, the social commentary web series and podcast, because it's my birthday. Ernestine Lyons, your host, has officially turned 35, and I am super, super excited to be in a whole different demographic now. No more 18 to 34, and now it's 35 to 55, or wherever the cutoff is. And I'm joined by a very special guest here, one of my dear friends, Matthew Rowling. And so tell us a little bit about yourself, Matthew, before we jump right into these questions. And of course, I'm going to have some top, yesterday, January 6th, I think is going to be a date that lives in infamy, and a whole lot of craziness went down. So we're going to get some of your thoughts, and we are going to talk a little bit about that. But our main topic is, Matthew being the financial and, small business whiz that he is. So I'm going to stop talking because I love to talk. So, and I'm just going to tell us about yourself, sir.
Well, Ernestine, for starters, happy birthday. But you forgot to mention a really important thing that happens when you turn 35. You are constitutionally eligible to run for president of the United States.
I feel like that was one of the first things I ever learned about, U.S. civics, because I was that kid who read Jimmy Carter's biographies, when we were hanging out at my cousin's house and they were just like, you're doing what? And so I don't know why that slipped my mind. Like, thank you for bringing that up.
And I mean, I don't know. I think that you would be equally, if not more qualified than a lot of people that we've seen run in the recent year or actually win. I think you're more qualified than people who have won the presidency in recent years. So, now's the time to throw your hat in the ring there, Ernestine.
Well, I'm glad you have faith in believe that I can actually do that. I know personally I'm not ready for that yet. I need a little bit more legislative experience. Maybe mayor. I did kind of have a big announcement today. To bring things back, what are some of your thoughts on, just the need for folks to, and I know you and I have talked about this personally before, the need for folks to feel that things are so extreme that they need to storm the Capitol. And, it's almost like we were witnessing something that happens in emerging markets and developing economies where, you'll have a dictator or some sort of despot who's like, refuses to relinquish power. And then he tells, his supporters like, well, this is unacceptable, storm the Capitol. And, so I just think that this is very telling that these are such extreme times that people think they need to resort to extreme measures. And I feel like this is as extreme as it gets, the legislature had to be evacuated. And, you just saw something that was, to me, very, very extreme, and it's very sad, a very sad chapter in our nation's history.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love, I obviously what happened yesterday is despicable and tragic, but I really liked how you used you referenced the developing world as a place where we kind of expect this thing to happen. And my response to that, when you're in the thick of things, it's really easy to see the fire, and it's hard to see the tinder or the kindling. one of the things that the tinder or the kindling, in my opinion, over the last 50 years, you know, there is a statistical measure of wealth inequality in countries, and it's called the Gini Index, G-I-N-I. And so the Gini Index is a coefficient that measures the difference between the haves and the have-nots. And over the last 50 years in the United States, that inequality has gradually increased in a very steep manner. And I think it's starting in the last 20 or 30 years, it has reached into the pocket of, there's been so much ink spilled about this. But it's just become such a flashpoint for the US, and that impact of policies in the US that have gutted the middle class and globalization, the latter being something that has done a lot to bring people out of poverty and create tremendous wealth, you know, it's finally starting to reach its hands into the pockets of, you know, the people who didn't expect it to reach into their pockets. And so now they feel oppressed, and then it makes it really easy for people like Donald Trump to use identity politics to divide us. There's a ton of research that shows, this is where I'm bringing it home. There's a ton of research that shows that countries that have really high levels of wealth inequality, they are much more likely to engage in violent combat with, you know, they're more likely to go to war. They're more likely to have political division, their social institutions are less stable. So if you take a huge step back, the root problem underlying all this is wealth inequality.
Right, right. And you did hit on a point about, you know, the impact of policies that have really gradually declined the middle class. And so now you have these extremes. And I think that when people are feeling desperate and they're feeling marginal, they will start to, you know, it's almost like you have so much decision fatigue going on that you become susceptible to, you know, having someone come along and, you know, place the blame outside of your own shortcomings, because you feel like a constant failure when the middle class and when society is failing you, when it's not there, when you don't have the social safety nets, and when you don't have all of those things that were once in place that provided a robust middle class, you know, in the 1960s, and you had the Great Society, and you had all of these programs that, you know, really helped to, you know, just give people a life, and there was upward mobility, and one generation was going to do better than the next. And so now we're finding that is actually gradually eroding. And so now what recourse do people have when they feel that, well, it's my own failing, it's my own shortcoming, I am, you know, just really losing it, and I'm losing control of, you know, any type of way I can really make life better for myself and for, you know, my family. And so then when someone comes along and says, oh, well, it's the immigrants, oh, well, it's somebody else, it's not you, it's, you know, the Democrats are socialists, and, you know, it's, you know, Antifa, it's this, it's that. And when you're constantly, you know, putting a scapegoat out there, then people who are feeling, you know, super, you know, marginalized, and they're feeling like they're left out, their voices are not being heard, of course they're going to feel, you know, like, this is the time to, you know, to be really extreme. And this is the one person who's listening to us. And it's almost like gaslighting behavior, the way who's manipulative will be like, well, I'm the only person who really listens to you and really understands you. And it's just like, you're a billionaire, dude. How do you understand someone who, you know, is living paycheck to paycheck, and, you know, you don't even really understand how much milk a gallon of milk costs? So it's like that rhetoric is allowed to really proliferate because of the fact that, you know, folks are feeling like they aren't being heard. And, you know, since the 1970s, there's been mistrust in government ever since Nixon and the Watergate scandal. So, it's just a progression of, you know, whoever is going to try to speak to me and my needs and identify with me versus, you know, some elite. And I think that's the real division. It's like now everybody on the left is an elitist. They're, you know, against me, and, you know, I'm never ever going to identify with them. And then they elect, you know, candidates who are going to double down on things like, you know, you saw the Tea Party rise during, you know, the Obama administration. And so this is really just the height of where that movement was going. And it's just sad because, you know, many people have echoed, you know, the sentiments that, you know, I know to be true just being an African American and living an African American experience in America. It's like, if these were, you know, Black Lives Matter protesters, they would not have made it, you know, beyond the Capitol steps. You know, this would have been bloodier. And it's just, you know, it kind of shows this type of, you know, privilege that is, you know, able to really permeate our society. And I think, you know, having conversations with Republican friends and colleagues, that even they are acknowledging that, you know, the culture needs to change within the party. And, you know, me as a Democrat, I'm just like, I'm not really even seeing where the party is really, I don't know what the future is now that, you know, there's just a whole different administration, but I'm not necessarily seeing that people are being as extreme as what is called for to have a little bit more, you know, change. So, you know, those are just my thoughts on everything that happened yesterday. And, you know, our country definitely needs to put in some work, and, you know, we have to do better, you know, to just make sure that our future is one that's going to be helpful for everyone to feel heard in this country, because obviously nobody is feeling heard if you have these kind of extremes that are happening. So on that note, we're going to digress, unless you have something like else to add to that. You know, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, in the 1950s, after World War II, with all the modern conveniences, we started to see a lot of women enter the workforce. And we very quickly realized that for a lot of reasons, women were making about 50 cents on the dollar compared with men in equivalent jobs. And over the last 60 years, we've made a lot of progress to compress that gap. And, you know, the reason I bring up that example is when you look at wealth in African-American communities, if you belong to the majority class, right? If you're European ancestry, or if you're affluent, you know, I meet a lot of people who are kind of like libertarian. They believe we live in a post-racial society, and you know, that people just need to kind of quote unquote get over it, right? But the reality is, and the statistic that I'd really like people to start focusing in on is, you know, the average Black family has a net worth that's about 10% of the net worth of a white family. But the tragedy is that hasn't budged in about 50 years. If anything, it's only been exacerbated by, you know, the recession in 2008 and the recession here in 2020 from the quarantine in COVID. So if either, you know, I think, you know, it's not our job to rub that statistic in the face of the people who believe we live in a post-racial society. I think it's their responsibility to understand it, and that the impact that structural racism in 400 years of treating Black people with terribly has resulted in. But, you know, the focus has to be on compressing that gap and helping. And it's the same. It's very similar for Latino families, too. It's about Latino families. It's about 6-7x. They make about 15. Their worth, the family's net worth, is about 15, 20 cents on the dollar for your average white family. So I'd really like to see, you know, instead of focusing on the flames, I'd like to see us all the progress that we made compressing that gap for women. For income and for incomparable jobs of men, I'd like to see us put on a full on assault on bridging that gap for families of color as well. So.
Oh, I wasn't on mute that whole time. Interesting. So probably picking up all kinds of noises. But no, I think that It's really important to acknowledge that. I was having a conversation with one of my friends who's working on, shout out to Donnie. And we were talking about the fact that there is an anti-blackness that permeates, the society here. And so, when it comes to something that, and this was something that, I've heard statistics on as well, where it's like when it comes to, African Americans having the same rights or being on equal footing or even just getting up to, a leveled playing field, is going to be, I'd rather sacrifice myself so that they don't benefit, as opposed to, level the playing field so that everyone has a fair chance. It's like, I'm forgetting her name, but she was, she's the author of the 1619 Project, and she was behind the scenes of that, and she kind of mentioned that, a lot of social programs that came out of the Great Society, under Lyndon Johnson, people became resentful of those programs because they did help alleviate poverty for African Americans. And really, the whole goal for Lyndon Johnson was to alleviate poverty in America. But, if you have black people and poor people and white people who are poor people, and it's like you want to get rid of it overall. But I think that's something that, is a societal ill where, okay, well, no, if it's benefiting this person more, then I don't want it to be a thing at all. When really it's only benefiting one person more because maybe there's more poverty there than there is in other areas. So, it's just it's quite a quickie a tricky conundrum, and that's something that it really I really want to get to the bottom of like why the problem is like anti-black, and why it seems to be something that even in the 21st century, so 2021, we're in a whole different decade, this is still something that is an issue that we're going to still have to talk about.
Well, I mean, the biggest driver of household wealth for most Americans is home ownership. And the US government discriminated in mortgage markets with redlining against black families until the 60s and 70s. And so that was almost in my lifetime, right? And so the for 90 for 95% of the African American experience in the US, there were systems in place that prevented people of color from owning homes or owning homes in desirous neighborhoods. And then if and when they did, those homes would be white flight would often drive the asset values down, right? So I just think people who are quick to dismiss the need to kind of target people of color are kind of ignoring that those facts. Having said that, I mean, tribalism is so strong, and identity politics are so strong, and we talked about all the challenges that our country's facing at the top of the pro at the top of the program. So I agree with you that people like you, elected leaders, and other people who work in policy, if you try to design tools to address income or wealth inequality that feel like they cherry-pick certain groups of people, I think personally that they can sometimes be destined to fail for the reasons you just pointed out, and that no one wants to see, not no one. There are many groups of people who don't like to see somebody who doesn't look like them get what they perceive to be a hand up from the government, right? And so it's a tricky situation, but I think if people like you and others can just roll, I mean, poverty comes in all colors, and so if you just kind of your rhetoric and you roll up your sleeves and you treat poverty with kind of a colorblind attitude, hopefully the electorate will follow. So.
these are our hopes, and you know, this is what we would like to see, you know, in a someday sort of scenario. But in the meantime, you know, you were very right with, you know, you have folks, you know, like me who are elected who want to fight for, you know, just making sure that everybody feels heard. Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I just want to make sure that, you know, people don't feel so left out that they have to resort to things like yesterday. And, you know, I think that's just as, you know, important as making sure that, you know, people are not being murdered, you know, in the streets for just being Black. And, you know, so it's so just shifting back to, you know, the topic, I think that, you know, I'm going to transition right into our main discussion here. And are there anything else you want, like, the audience to know about you? And also,
oh yeah, I never introduced myself.
Yeah, you did.
So yeah, I lead innovation and entrepreneurship at Wayne State University, and I teach personal finance and corporate finance from time to time. And you know, as you mentioned, I've been a consultant for small business in organizations that serve small business, and so that's my gig. So I live in Detroit, and really always enjoy talking, always enjoy chopping it up with you, Ernestine, especially when talking about fun stuff. So.
When it's Ernestine, is always fun stuff, because, you know, I bring the fun to the equation. So I do want to just kind of transition into one of our first questions. Let's talk about saving during unprecedented times. This is, matter of fact, this is how we first connected, you know, as friends. And, you know, you were talking to a lot of companies and businesses about how to pivot during a pandemic, how to, you know, really be able to anticipate, you know, for the unforeseen. And so how can businesses and individuals, you know, start to plan for these types of shortfalls where, you know, income may be interrupted, or, you know, just the type of revenue you're expecting isn't coming in because maybe you own a restaurant. So let's talk a little bit more about that, and, you know, what we can do to, you know, continue in 2021.
Yeah, I think if you're running a household, or if you're running a business at any given point in time, or any point during the course of a day, there's kind of three hats you're wearing right now. There's emergency room doctor, cheerleader, and visionary. And you know, the emergency room doctor, you know, cash is the lifeblood of a household budget, and cash is the lifeblood of a business. And so the emergency room doctor, you know, you have to have a razor sharp focus on your cash and the people you owe money to. And so for people, if it doesn't matter if you dropped out of high school or if you have a PhD from MIT, people, the way that our brains process money, we think it is incredibly analytical and calculating but it's not. We all really kind of struggle with the same behavioral economic traps. And so the ground zero for the emergency room doctor, in my opinion, is a daily spending diary. And you keep it for at least a month, ideally 2 to 3, and you immediately start saving money. You immediately start to identify extraneous spend. And most importantly, you finally have a really good handle on how much your life costs. And so everybody always says, like, make a budget and stick to it, make a budget and stick to it. My response to that is, with what, right? If you want me to make a budget, I'm just gonna kind of pull it out of the sky. But if I, you know, every single day I'm looking at the money that I'm spending on, you know, cell phone, utility, rent, lease, you know, clothing, food, healthcare, childcare, you know, professional services, whatever it is, right? Over the course of a month, you will get a really good handle on how much your life costs. And once you have a handle on how much your life costs, then it becomes really easy to build things like emergency funds, right? Everyone's like, you need 6 months of emergency funds in the bank. Well, what's 6 months? What's of what, right? So I really think that's the emergency room doctor. You know, the cheerleader is just you know, there it, this is crazy. I mean, you know, there are so many families that are struggling right now. They're struggling with childcare. They're struggling to stay in their homes. They're struggling to put food on the table. You know, it's the cheerleader is, you know, we're all in this together, and it's not your fault, right? But easy to say, hard to do. You know, it's really scary getting phone calls from creditors and collection agencies. It's really scary talking to your credit card companies or your bank to try and figure out a solution that works for everybody. But that cheerleader hat that everyone has to wear, if you're a business owner or you're head of household, you know, you got to stick with it. You got to your the Our natural instinct is to put our head in the sand. You want to pull your head out, right? And deal with your problems face on. And remember that, you know, these are unprecedented times. For the visionary hat, you know, that is the hardest of the three hats. And it's a rare trait for a business owner or individual to put that hat on. Because what that hat does is it says, wait a minute, the world just had a seismic shift. What does this mean for my career, or what does this mean for my business, right? How are the changes in the world fundamentally, you know, it's not going to go back to normal, right? We're 10 months into it. You know, anyone that thinks, you know, we're just gonna, you know, go right back to February 2020 is living in a fool's paradise. Okay, so what does that mean? Do I need to go back to school to learn how to code software? Do I need to, you know, get a certification in data and analytics? Do I need to learn how to become a pipe fitter or a skilled tradesperson, right? Like, what are the alternatives that how do I up if I have the freedom and the capacity and the resources, how can I upskill to prepare for the future, right? If you're a business owner, you know, you've already had 10 months of dealing with that. But still, I think there's a lot of people, you know, if you own a movie theater, right, you've made all this huge investment in theaters, you know, on if every single person in America was vaccinated tomorrow, I still don't think all the people that went to movies are going to immediately rush back to the movie theater, right? And even if they do, what does that mean? What does it look like? So emergency room doctor to keep an eye on your cash. Cheerleader to keep your spirits up for you and your family, or you and your employees, and to remember that this is, you know, not a moral failing. And then the visionary, you know, what happens next, and how do I best prepare myself for that future? So it's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask anyone. You know, those are three incredibly different people, so or personas.
Right. And I love that, you know, the imagery that you put out there, like the emergency room doctor, you're having, you know, the cheerleader and the visionary, and you have to be all of those things. And then you want to encourage those around you, you know, as, you know, leaders of organizations and, you know, companies, you know, company owners who are, you know, hoping to keep, you know, just the morale up of, you know, their employees. So, you know, I think this is it's really important, and I think it creates that visual of it's going to stick with people, because, you know, when you talk about saving and things like that, where it's like, okay, well, if income is interrupted, you know, how am I really going to save? And, you know, I think this is something that, you know, we really should start looking at how to make sure that we're keeping track of things, and, you know, just kind of keeping, you know, tabs on where your money is going and being really intentional about it. I think a lot of folks in my generation are, you know, embracing minimalism because they want to be intentional about things and not just be blindly spending. And, you know, to be able to anticipate, you know, living a better life and providing. And then also, I know that the FIRE movement is actually pretty big with, you know, millennials wanting to, you know, retire early and, you know, just kind of live financially independently. But, you know, you talked about the seismic shift and, you know, making that true and impactful change. So I kind of want to ask a little bit more about, you know, making that change happen with long-term wealth creation. So that's something I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, because, You've worked in these arenas with, starting your own companies and working with, other startups, and then also with the Quicken Loans arena, and under venture capital, and just all of these different innovative companies. And so you kind of see how people are really able to make these things happen. So I just want to ask you a little bit more about that, and like how you can elaborate on how everyday normal people can, because I'm just a normal little person, and how can I do more to make these kind of decisions, the way that you would guide, say, a think tank or a startup to make the same kind of decisions. And my laptop is about to die, so I'm gonna, as you answer, plug this guy in.
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, when you're trying to create, when you're trying to build your net worth, the number one, the starting point is to make sure that you don't have any toxic debt. You can safely assume that all credit card debt is toxic debt, right? Your average credit card in the United States charges a 15% APR. A lot of them will be up to 20-25%.
Of toxic debt, because that's a new term for me.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of pulling that one out of my fanny, but I would say, there's if you have a mortgage and you just got it a month ago and it's at 2% interest, you should be taking all the time in the world to pay that off, right? 2% is an amazingly small amount of money to pay to borrow money, and you should be in no hurry to pay that off. That's good debt, right? Assuming you bought a home you like and it's, all that kind of good stuff. If you have $5,000 in credit card debt and you're paying 20% interest, you're literally paying $1,000 a year to borrow that money, right? To give you, to kind of, do the math for you, a $50,000 mortgage at 2% has the same annual interest as $5,000 in credit card debt at 20%. The same, right? You borrow 50 grand to buy a home, right? Or maybe that's a small home, but if you do a home equity line, right? So the $5,000 for the credit card, you've got to get out from underneath that. So let's just assume you've done that, and because I'm not answering your question. The most people receive their money from a W-2, right? I work for Wayne State and I receive a salary, and I receive that money in the form of a W-2, right? In order to really create wealth, you need to own assets. And as much as I love, sneakers and artwork and fine wine, and I think Bitcoin is one of the most interesting things that's happened to the economy in a long time, the tried and true method is owning real estate, or you own securities in businesses. And when you own real estate or you own securities in businesses, and you do a really good job of vetting opportunities and making wise decisions with your money, and you allow yourself some room for error, and you make it a habit, and you make it part of a longer term strategy, you can really build substantial amounts of wealth. I'm not here to sell any books on real estate. I'll leave that to the people that wake up at 2 a.m. and can't go back to bed and turn on the TV. But real estate is, yeah, right. Real estate is so tax advantaged. It's the only asset class where someone's going to loan you 80%, right? Like if I want to go buy a stock for $100, no one's going to loan me 80 or 90 bucks to buy the stock, right? So real estate, you can borrow, you get a tremendous amount of leverage, you borrow money. It's incredibly tax advantaged. And, with the exception of 2008 and 2009, it generally increases in value. Now, when you make mistakes in real estate, they're big mistakes, right? A $250,000 home in the wrong neighborhood that doesn't go up in value is a really big mistake. But over time, you can create tremendous value. Investing in the stock market, I'm extremely disappointed in Robinhood as a product. The number one rule of technology is that if it's free, that means you're the product. And Robinhood is already probably, is already getting sued in a couple different states, because Robinhood has essentially turned day trading into a user interface that looks and acts like a slot machine. And they sell your data to Wall Street. Oh, by the way, right? That's how they make their living. People that tell you that they make money day trading are akin to people that tell you that they always win at the casino. They suffer from selective amnesia. And most research tells us that about 90%+ of people that engage in day trading lose. Having said that, I say that not to discourage people from buying stocks and bonds. It's quite the opposite, because the beautiful thing about the stock market, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
But you want to do it the right way, because it seems like, I heard a lot of good things about Robinhood, and I had entertained, I actually downloaded the app, but then I had a brokerage account. So when I first started investing, which was this year, in stocks, I went ahead and used that like a Chase account, and but people were like, well, why not use Robinhood? Because I have so many questions sometimes, and I'll just call the bank guy and ask these questions, but they're like, well, Robinhood will explain it for you. And I didn't realize it was that whole you're the product, because same thing people ask about Facebook, how does it make money? You're the product. Wow.
You're the product, absolutely. And then not only that, but Robinhood doesn't give you best execution, whereas your Chase account or my Ally account or E-Trade, Ameritrade, when I buy or sell a stock on a traditional brokerage platform, they're going to take that security and they're going to put it in a batch and sell it or buy it. And what Robinhood does is they'll batch other users' orders and kind of sit on them until they get it to a certain size where they'll get a good price. Which ultimately can help Robinhood make more money. So I think Robinhood is a horrible product. I'm more than happy to tell anyone that's listening to uninstall the, close your account and uninstall your app and put your money in a traditional brokerage account and use it there. Over the long run, if you buy and hold stocks, you will win, right? If you're not willing to roll up your sleeves and dive into real estate, or you don't have the time or the effort or the patience or the connections or the network, right? And you don't have the or the effort to put money in your friend's business, like something like that would come, right? The stock market is, if you buy and hold, you can win. You just have to give it time. You just have to be patient, right? With real estate or if I put money in, a restaurant, that became a big winner 3, 4, 5 years later, I might get a lot of money, right? But the stock market's a marathon. And if you have a 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 year time horizon, you'll win. You just have to be in the market and you just have to forget about it, right? Buy securities that are, build with the help of a professional, if you have one, or if you have the interest in learning yourself. Put together a really nice, diverse portfolio and just keep adding to it. You take advantage of retirement accounts at work if you have them, and purchase securities that have very low fees. Because sometimes these mutual funds or these exchange traded funds that people like to invest in have very high fees. And a very high fee might be 1% a year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but over the course of 20 years, that can result in thousands and thousands of dollars.
You actually did answer a lot of the other questions that I, did have here on, stocks and bonds, and, because that is a very hot topic. And I know that in 2020, we saw a lot of folks who are like, especially with that whole Robinhood model where it's like, oh, okay. And I think that's a play on the name. It's just like, you're taking from the rich who, it seems that investing in stocks and bonds and things of that, it was like only for a certain class of people, but now it's putting it into the hands of the normal person. And it shows, I remember their commercials were showing, a young grocery clerk guy, stocking the groceries, but then he was also buying stock, and it's just like, oh, he's a normal person and he's buying stock. But it's this is a very confusing area for a lot of people, and they started getting into this in 2020. And you see a lot of folks who like, do you want to get rich? Let's do forex trading. And I can't tell you how many people send me like Instagram messages like, I want to know more about forex trading. So just kind of I want to talk a little bit more about the lowdown, and I know you did already talk on some of these issues, and you brought some issues to the light on investment decisions and bonds in particular, and money market accounts and cryptocurrencies, and should we be investing in these more, and what is the future of that? We did talk about on one of my shows in December, we had David Silversmith come on, and he talked a little bit about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. But it's such an interesting topic. Let's like dive into all of that a little more.
Cryptocurrency in particular, or just like what? Well, let me. I'm going to take one little step back, and then I'm going to let you clarify. So, there are two ways to become very rich very fast in the United States of America. You buy a winning lottery ticket, or you are born to a mother who is really wealthy. That is it, And so, everything else, if it's becoming a YouTube influencer, if it's investing in art or wine or watches or Bitcoin or real estate, takes time, effort, patience, capital, right? I will tell you my own personal story. When I was 30, I made a lot of money, and I was, you could almost argue, with the exception of my dedication to my retirement accounts, was almost living paycheck to paycheck. I had a huge condo, a motorcycle, a car, all the kind of trappings of somebody who makes a good living. And when I was your age, I downsized to a 700 square foot co-op. I sold my car, my motorcycle, and my loft. And it was like overnight, my net worth started to just skyrocket because I carved a ton of expenses out of my fixed costs, right? I didn't have a $1,200 mortgage a month anymore. I had no mortgage, because I had my HOAs at this co-op because it wasn't a big place, right? So, you can make drastic changes to reduce your fixed costs and your spending and get out of debt. There's no silver bullet. Forex trading, when it comes to Forex trading or options or the stock market, here's the problem. Every single year, there is an army of people that graduates with PhDs from and MBAs from Harvard and Oxford and Michigan and on and on and on. And they move to London and Frankfurt and Tokyo and New York and Chicago. And their job every day is to take money from people that think they can beat the market. So if you think that you can beat them, and oh, by the way, when it comes to like technology and services and memberships and support, they have all the money in the world. You can't beat them, right? Like trading Forex, trading stock, day trading stocks or bonds you can't beat them. But the beautiful thing is they don't care about you retire like 30 years from now. They don't care. Their job's to beat you today, not tomorrow. So if you have time and patience, you can win. Now, Bitcoin is one of the single most interesting things that has happened in the business world in the last 20 years. No one knows who made it. The ability the using the currency, using the mining of the currency as a system for creating trust in a trust-free environment is so creative and so imaginative and so cool, it's mind-bending. If you, I think that holding a little bit of cryptocurrency in a well-balanced portfolio is not a bad idea, and holding some Bitcoin is essentially a call option on our economy shifting drastically, right? Now, on a day-to-day basis, money is used for three things. It's a store of value, it's a means of exchange, and it's a measure of worth, right? Bitcoin is one of those things. It's a store of value. Because when we talk about Bitcoin, we say, oh, did you hear Bitcoin is 15 grand, right? Like, I don't hear people saying, hey, do you want to buy my car? It's two Bitcoins. The moment that people start to truly use Bitcoin as a means of exchange or as a measure of value, then it's game over for Bitcoin. But I think we're a long, long way from that. We're a long, long ways away from that. And for now, Bitcoin's purpose, which I hate to say it, but it's really true, is to facilitate illicit trade, right? You can use Bitcoin on the black market to buy drugs or guns or anything else horrible that you don't want the world to know about. And that's really the purpose that it serves from a commercial standpoint.
Wow. So that's definitely mind blowing. And, you know, no one knows who made Bitcoin, which actually just kind of sets it up for being this kind of, you know, black market kind of thing where, you know, okay, well, this is what we're doing with it right now. But I think it is also exciting that, you know, once we start to put value to it and we start, you know, using it as some sort of a thing, it's almost like when the European Union shifted over from, you know, all of their different monetary units to euros. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, how much is this really? And is it really going to, you know, make our economy stronger? Because that's really the whole mission behind it, was to be just as strong as like the dollar or some of the other Asian currencies. So it's really fascinating that, you know, this has become something that people are talking about so much, and that, you know, it how many years do you think it's going to be before, you know, and this is just like you guesstimating, you know, before this is something that we start to put that kind of value to, and we like, okay, well, this is a actual currency and we're going to start using this for like your car example. Like, I just bought a new used car. It was, you know, really affordable. So it's just like, okay, that's two Bitcoins or something, or one Bitcoin for the car. So, when is that going to happen?
Well, you know, my hunch, you know, historically, for people who are investing or interested in, you know, diversifying their portfolio, gold, investing in gold was always seen as a part of a diversified portfolio to help you weather economic downturns. It was seen as a contrarian asset class, right? And typically, when times were bad, gold went up in price, and when times were good, gold went down in price. And I see Bitcoin, I'm not making this up. I'm not a genius. We are already seeing Bitcoin begin to displace gold as that flight to quality asset. Because as I said, Bitcoin is kind of you're kind of making a bet that the global economy will collapse and turn into this wild, wild west, which, hey, you know, as we talked about earlier, it's, you know, maybe not beyond the pale of imagination, but when it comes to Bitcoin displacing U.S. currency, there's a lot of paranoid people out there that thinks the big banks run the world, and you know, they're all right, and so, you know, I just don't see a future where, you know, JP Morgan and Chase and Bank of America, you know, the big banks in Europe, if we ever begin to even get close to the moment where Bitcoin it begins to usurp their role, and let's not forget credit card companies either. If we ever begin to get to a point where Bitcoin begins to displace their role in maintaining our economy, they'll either come up with a better mousetrap or they'll destroy it. They'll find a way. There's just no way that the banks would ever allow Bitcoin to become a measure of value or a means of exchange. It's just not going to happen.
Almost feels like the analogy of, like, I remember just being a historian, reading about the fact that the big three, you know, didn't want to allow other modes of transportation to, you know, kind of cut into their all of their wealth. And, you know, once upon a time in Detroit, there were streetcars that went everywhere. And, you know, people wanted to have more, you know, kind of like in Chicago, you have the elevated trains and more mass transit so that people didn't have this dependency on cars. And so, but it was an industry which just like, no, like the banks are not going to allow like a cryptocurrency to, kind of take over and replace that monetary unit that people are going to need. And, it's kind of the same as that auto industry. It's like, nope, we're the only game in town. And then it kind of contributed to, we don't have a diversified economy here in Michigan because, we were, the only game in town was the auto industry. So, I think this is something that innovators have come along and presented a new alternative. And I think considering I love history so much because there are always these epochs of, you are presented with a new concept and then, something else comes along and replaces it. And I think when you look at history, this is the longest amount of time that we've spent in just one era where the things that we have are the way we do things and nothing has replaced it. And it seems like every 100 years there's going to be something that comes along and replaces something that is, something gets antiquated. And now you have this revolutionary thing that's just changing our lives, and we're resistant to that. The 20th century and now the 21st century is kind of seeing this resistance. And I hope that we can continue to push for innovation, and that this could be something that becomes a way to level the playing field, so to speak. But
I agree with you, Ernestine, and me stating that I don't think that Bitcoins could supplant big banks. It's not that's not a it's certainly not a moral statement on my part that I think that's right. And everything that you just talked about, in my opinion, speaks to the Western world's corporatism. And what I mean by corporatism is that large companies in the Western world have so much wealth and influence that they're able to control, through lobbying efforts and other means, the tax, the regulatory environment, and they where they can't, they'll use mergers and acquisitions to kind of gobble up competition. So, as much as we like to think we live in a really innovative age, we don't. New business creation on a per capita basis in the US has fallen steadily in the last 40 years, and the single biggest reason is because all of these large corporate players are putting moats around themselves that have really prevented innovation.
Right, they're becoming the monopolies. They're becoming like the big boxes are becoming, Jeff Bezos is on track to trillionaire. And it's just the way that our world is changing, and the now that there is so much wealth to be had and so many inequalities, it's like, oh, well, we like this system, so let's fight tooth and nail to prevent progress. So, and I mean, like, when you think about like 100 years ago or so, you had the captains of industries, the JP Morgans, the and fought against, any type of change, and they were more powerful than the government, which is why you had a lot of regulations. And I think now it's going to be even more of a challenge because of the nature of capitalism, to a lot of our politicians are bought and paid for, so why fight against it when you can just be on the payroll? So I'm going to transition with that into our last question, and give you back some of your time. And at just kind of as far as money related topics have historically been, kind of taboo in our country, and what are some common mistakes that people make with money? I know you did touch on some of these topics about, not necessarily budgeting or writing things down or actually tracking. Matter of fact, I realized that there was a, an app I had downloaded and delete it, and it was every month for like 6 months taking out like six, it was a small amount, but it was like $6.99 every month. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. I thought that was a free app. And so I think it's important to not make those kind of money mistakes. But why are money topics in America taboo? And tell us how to avoid these mistakes, oh wise one.
Yeah, no, I mean, first off, I think your comparison with the Gilded Age is very apropos. That was also a period in history when the US had a very high Gini coefficient, and corporate titans were, buying politicians to do whatever they wanted. So I think your historical, reference point is a good one. for starters, technology has allowed commerce to tokenize so much. And, you know, when something becomes a recurring monthly payment, or when we pay for things with our credit cards, you know, mentally, from a behavioral economic perspective, it's really easy, right? If you wanna save money, stop carrying around your credit card and pay for everything in cash. You will spend 20 to 30% less immediately, right? I know that's a hard thing to do with COVID, so maybe some of my rubber remarks can be pre-COVID. Common mistakes people make. So money taboo, you know, if there's an asymmetry of information and no one knows what other people make at work and no one talks about what people make, you know, that helps an employer, right? Because if you don't know that the person sitting next to you that does the exact same job makes $80,000 and you're making $65,000, you're not going to ask me for $80,000, right? So the taboo around talking about money helps employers. I'm not saying we all need to go around and talk about how much money we make, but I'm just saying that, you know, we kind of need to. I think some people get a little bit too fired up, right? And the reason people get fired up is because we commingle our moral feelings about us with our income or our wealth or our purchasing power. So, you know, we need to stop. You know, you need to divorce your personal happiness, your personal sense of well-being from your money matters, because they're different. And, you know, as we talked about, you know, who you are, where you are, what you look like, how old you are, how educated you are. Statistically, these things are all tremendous drivers of how much money you have and how wealthy you are. When it comes to good decisions and bad decisions, I'm a huge fan of automating good behavior, right? Like, and one of the beautiful things about living in 2021, rather, is that there are a lot of really cool fintech tools. And so I can automate my bill pay. I can automate my 401k withdrawals. I can automate my IRA contributions. And so I'm a big believer in set it and forget it, right? You know, put together a really good comprehensive strategic plan, set it and forget it, put it on autopilot. And I'm also a big fan of hacking your brain, right? If you want to save a couple grand for a trip 12 months from now, and you want to go to Hawaii, right? Print out a picture of Hawaii and put some tape on it and tape it to your credit card. You will spend less money. Every time you pull out your credit card, you'll see, oh yeah, I want to go to Hawaii. I can either go to Hawaii in 6 months, or I can, you know, buy the pair of jeans and go to Hawaii in 7 months, right? So I think so much of good money behavior is about creating empathy for your future self, right? You're 35 today. You need to have a conversation with yourself and say, what does 50-year-old Ernestine Lyons want me to be doing today? You know, have that conversation with yourself in 15 years and plan accordingly, because she's going to tell you exactly what she wants you to do, you know, and if you do what she wants, you will be pointed in the right direction. And that's just my kind of off the cuff podcast answer for you.
Well, you know what? Thank you so much. I had to take those things off. These are newish headphones, and they were driving my head crazy. But I think it's really important to be able to anticipate what your future self is going to need. And that's something that I'll look back on, certain things that were, you know, oh, that bill's already going to be paid. And, you know, it's just so nice. It's like, oh my gosh, my past self, I thank her because she was so, you know, intuitive, and she was so nice to be able to do the right thing as opposed to go spend all her money on cookies and sweets, which is what old me would do. And just go nuts with, you know, buying those box of Ferrero Rochers, you know, and, you know, all of these kind of things that, you know, I really love. Sweets are my weakness. I bought a $30 cake and for Christmas, and it kind of went to waste. because I'm like, wait a minute, I did not need that. So it's just, really being able to, yeah, I feel so bad about that. But yeah, it's like making the right decision because, in buying things on a whim is something that, I've been reading a lot of articles about, like having a no spend year, and that cake on a whim that was just really beautiful and it was peppermint, and I'm like, my family's gonna love it. And honestly, none of us have ever had a peppermint cake before. And so just kind of anticipating like what your needs are actually gonna be and then actually moving in on that. So yeah.
I always, whenever it's a major purchase, like for starters, the whole point of having money is to live your life on your terms. The point of money is not to become a millionaire. There's no gold medal for being the richest person in the graveyard. You need to have money that supports your life on your terms, right? So I just want to say that, like, I'm not a big fan of the FIRE movement, your early retirement people. I'm not suggesting people should all run off and become monks. But one of the tools I always like to play is I play the opportunity cost game. And so, imagine that, you let's like let's take that cake for a second. Let's say that you were, at the store and you saw the cake, and all of a sudden a genie appeared. And the genie said, "You know what, Ernestine? I have a boy, do I have a deal for you. I'm either going to give you the cake for free, or I'm going to give you 30 bucks. And if you play the opportunity cost game, you probably would have taken the 30 bucks, right? And so, if you play the game, the times when the genie deal for the car or the house or the cake is the more compelling offer, then you know that, you should buy the thing. You should buy the jeans, you should buy the flight, you should buy the car, whatever. But I always like to ask the genie whether or not I'd rather just take the cash.
When you put it that way, it does make, it almost like helps you eliminate that frivolous spending. Because, okay, I'd rather have, and this is why it's so hard to spend cash versus carrying around a credit card when it's out of sight, out of mind. And, matter of fact, I think I did put that cake on a credit card. It was a debit card. But the point, if I had $30 cash, which, in my more frugal times, it's getting cash out, having a budget and sticking to it, and then carrying that cash around and not taking my credit cards with me. It's like, being able to anticipate, what your goals are going to be, and then, in addition to mechanizing everything and adding, just making things easier for yourself and automating everything, you cut down on frivolous spending. And so it just makes life easier for yourself.
100%. It's magic. The opportunity cost genie is a magic person, is a magic genie. The
Well,
cost opportunity cost saving genie.
right. And you offered a lot of really great solid advice, and I want to thank you so much for, being a part of the show. This has been Quick to Politic, and our guest Matthew Rowling. Where can we find you out there on the interwebs? Where do you want people to find you?
Well, aside, I'm happily employed, doing great work at Wayne State, but my passion project is Professor X on YouTube, which is personal finance videos they're basically a letter to my 23-year-old self to be smart and thoughtful and to have a healthy relationship with money. So look for Professor X Personal Finance on YouTube, and please subscribe.
And I'll put a link there in the description for that channel and everything that it's I've been watching, and it's been really entertaining. A lot of pizza examples, a lot of advice that's really solid that I've been able to real world apply, and to even recommend to businesses and folks who are looking to really be able to survive and pivot and thrive. And then especially new year, new you. You want to have good. And you want to map out a brighter financial future for yourself. So, Matthew is definitely a great resource for that. And, I just want to thank you for all of the listeners out there and viewers. Remember to like, comment, and subscribe. And thank you so much, Matthew, for joining me. And this has been Quick to Politic. All right.
Have a wonderful birthday, Ernestine. Thank you so much for having me.